Think I was going to take it very seriously, but they wanted me to have music, like everyone in the family plays something, and we have music hells, the cousins come over, everybody, you know, we all played something. My sisters played the piano and cello, and my father had a violin that he was sort of self-taught, but he, so I soon surpassed his ability because he never really taken a lesson. But I went to this local teacher and then to Mimi Zweig, who was a big help to me, and she sort of led me to Mr. Gingold. I played for Gingold when I was 11. He came to a recital that I did, and afterwards I sort of, between me and my parents, we sort of begged him to be my teacher, and ironically, I had my first lesson with him at a summer camp in upstate New York, because that's where he taught at Meadowmount, a famous summer camp there. So I went there when I was 11 and 12, and had my first lessons with him there, and then came back home, and he became my teacher.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you say, Joseph Gingold's name is sort of up there in lights with the great fiddle teachers of the century, along with Dorothy DeLay and a few others. What makes a great teacher? What was it about Mr. Gingold that connected the two of you so profoundly?
Well, there's so many things. I mean, For one, he was an incredible violinist. I mean, you'd think that's a given, but it's not always the case with every teacher that they can actually demonstrate. Gingold just had the most beautiful sound of any violins I've ever heard before or since. He had a Stradivarius, and the sweetest sound. So having that in your ears, first of all, the best lesson you can ever have, because just imitation and example is the best way to teach, really. But having said that, he was not the kind of teacher that spoon-fed musical ideas. You know, do this and then do this and then play. Take time here and then do this. This is how you're going to play the Beethoven. He would not do that at all. He would ask questions. He would try to guide me through making music and making decisions about music and trying to get it. So actually, none of his students really sound the same. Which is, I think, that's a great teacher. Someone that really guides, because when I finally left him, he died in the mid 90s, and I had to. It wasn't a big shock. I didn't, he had given me the tools to be a musician and to teach yourself, and I was an individual. I wasn't a copy of my teacher. So mm-hmm. I think that is a mark of a great, great teacher. Someone that can do that.
Of all the secrets and all the words of wisdom that he gave to you over the years, what's the one thing you find yourself returning to before a big concert? Or,
well, I think the most important thing is just his values. Most importantly, of honesty, honest music making. Always asking yourself, is this honest? Are you doing something to get him? To get the audience, or because you heard it on a recording? He would try to strip me of that sort of affectations, things that might creep in from hearing something or not making sense because it wasn't coming really from me or from an honest place. So always asking yourself those questions as a musician, I think, is very important. And it's a lesson that I think I always do, because that's the way I think you can convince an audience, if you truly believe in what you're doing. And you can, in a way, you can't go wrong.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, so there you were, Josh, studying with Mr. Gingold. What was it that first led you to believe that you might make music your life? Was it a single incident, or did you wake up one morning and realize that the decision had sort of been made for you?
I don't remember a particular moment. Certainly there were turning points, going to the summer camp where all of a sudden I was surrounded by lots of great kids who were playing incredibly, and someone first gave me a tape of Heifetz playing Wieniawski Concerto there, and I would listen under my covers at night when we're supposed to have be asleep. I mean, that was the first time I actually listened to music for pleasure. That, what a thought, for a kid, because had to practice, and I enjoyed, in a certain way, playing. But all of a sudden, 11, 12, I started realizing, wow, music is just gives me goosebumps sometimes, and you start. I mean, that's what music should do. But then I started winning a few little competitions. I won a competition which gave me a chance to play with Riccardo Muti in the Philadelphia Orchestra when I was 14, and that was sort of set me off, and just played concerts. All of a sudden, they started paying me, and it became a profession. So I just fell into it. I never really made that choice. It just was my life.
It was sort of organic.
It was actually very organic. Mm-hmm. I never entered an international violin competition, where all of a sudden I was thrust into 100 concerts a year. It was sort of a gradual thing, and I didn't have musician parents, and I didn't have a teacher that was pushing me. Gingold, it was all about music. He didn't know anything about record companies or careers, modern careers. He was sort of from another time, and didn't really bother himself with all that. He wasn't pulling strings to try to get things for me. It was just all about music, and he kept it grounded for me.
So it sounds like that's the sort of advice you would give to
Absolutely.
A young fiddle player.
I think I get a lot of kids, they'll write me at my website, saying, I want to be a soloist. Do you make a lot of money? Some do that. I mean, most do not. Most just talk. The really nice letters I get when they say I inspired them to love music, and that happens on occasion. It's great. But my advice is always, you have to do it because you love, what you're doing. Because you never know what kind of career you're going to have as a musician. And my own career is varied. I play chamber music. I play solo things. I'd like to teach someday. I'm enjoying leading orchestras now with chamber orchestras and directing and doing things. So there's a lot of ways to make a career as a musician.
Well, may I ask you to play a bit more Kreisler?
Sure.
Now?
We're going to play the Liebeslied, which is one of another famous one from one of the Viennese style pieces. It's Liebeslied, which means love's sorrow.
Again, Joshua Bell and Matthew Bengtsson here at XM Satellite Radio. Violinist Joshua Bell and pianist Matthew Bengtson played the very lovely Liebeslied by Fritz Kreisler. This is Classical Confidential, an outgrowth of the very popular Artist Confidential series here at XM Satellite Radio. Again, we have been joined by some 40 or so of our closest friends. Anyone with a question for Josh, just make your way over to that microphone over on your right, and Josh will be happy to answer it, I'm sure.
Thank you very much for being here to share your talents and your thoughts. Very much appreciate it.
Pleasure, thank you.
You mentioned your the Stradivarius that Professor Gingold had. I wonder if you could share some thoughts on the instruments you've played, and in not only the one you have today, but also as you've transitioned from one to the other. What was it you were looking for in the instrument, and how did you know that that was the one that you wanted to play then?
Oh, okay, thank you. The first Stradivarius I ever heard was Gingold, and also the first one that I ever played. He would stick it in my hand on these certain occasions, and it would be this great treat because it did things that my little box at the time didn't do. All of a sudden, I heard these overtones and the sound, and like these, when I would play his instrument, that it was incredible. So that got me a taste for that. And then, as I was growing up in my early teens, I would borrow instruments of various qualities. I was very lucky to have been given at one point a Guarneri del Gesù and a Guadagnini and then another Guarneri. I didn't have the luxury of picking one that suited me exactly right, but I was certainly jumped to the chance to play on a great instruments that were borrowed for sometimes a year at a time. Then of course it's heartbreaking to have to give it back. Finally, at the age of 19, I bought my first Strat, and it became somewhat infamous because of its guitar shape. It didn't have corners, and so some of my first recordings that you see on the record cover, this funny-looking instrument. That's why I got it for 50% off or something. I don't know. it wasn't known as a performing instrument, sort of an oddity. But I used it for 4 years in my career until I could, and it was a pretty good one as strads go. Yes, and then when I was about 22 or something, I then bought the Tom Taylor Strad, which is a late period Strad, beautiful instrument, which had been lent to me for a couple of years, and then I bought it from them, and that served me for many, many years until 4 years ago I stumbled upon this, the one I have now, which is a great golden period. Really, it's on the top level, really, of Stradivarius, the top of the top, you might say, since the Stradivarius is, any Stradivarius is really the top. This one is made in 1713, almost 300 years old now, and I knew about it, because Norbert Breinin, the great violinist from the Amadeus Quartet, he played it, and I'd even tried it once when I played chamber music with him. And I'd heard about it even before that, because it was the famous Hubermann violin that was stolen from Hubermann, another great violinist in 1936. It was stolen from him at Carnegie Hall, so it was this big scandal, big famous story, because it disappeared for so many years, 50 years.
Take a moment and tell that story, because one of your big successes a few years ago was playing on the soundtrack to The Red Violin,
yes,
a great film which was all about this mysterious violin that had this
is true,
incredible
yeah.
history, and you're playing a violin that also has a very interesting mysterious history.
Yeah, it is kind of and on top of it all, this violin, as violins go, is quite red. The varnish is very red, mm-hmm. So it is sort of like the red violin. It's somewhat ironic, because I did do all this stuff, the music and the soundtrack, and was participating in the Red Violin, which John Corigliano won the Oscar for in 2000, I think. That movie was sort of plays into that whole romantic notion of where the violin has been in its 300 years, all the hands it's been in. In the movie, it had been through gypsies and orphanages and buried underground and uncovered and all this great stuff. But in fact, all great Stradivarius or great instruments of those times, they've been through things like that. And most of those stories we don't even know. They're lost with. We'll never know. But this one has quite a history with this being stolen and then being it's been stolen twice, actually, once even before that. Finally, it was recovered. It was played for 50 years by the thief in cafes and gigs in New York City, which is why nobody ever, he couldn't tell anyone, and nobody knew about it because he never tried to sell it or tried to get it looked at or cleaned. So when it was
because
finally,
it was hot.
It was hot. Yeah. It was hot. Exactly. What a secret he must have, been wanting to, dying to tell people. I've got a Strad, you know, his fellow strolling violinist. But I guess he couldn't say that. So when he died in supposed deathbed confession, but it's all a bit mysterious still. The violin was turned over to the insurance company who had paid out 50 years earlier, and it was taken to Charles Beer, the shop in London, where they had to really spend 9 months uncovering the original varnish, which is underneath, because there was so much grime and from 50 years of not being cleaned, and they spent 9 months making sure that they, you know, it's like cleaning the Sistine Chapel, you know, it's like you have to be very careful not to take out the original, and so now we're left with this beautiful red original varnish, and so I found it 4 years ago and fell immediately in love with it, and I've had it since. Mm.
Josh, you've made all manner of recordings. You mentioned the whole Red Violin project and recorded the concerto by the contemporary English composer Nicholas Maw. You've done all of the great standard literature concertos. You've done these great suite recordings, the West Side Story suite and the Porgy and Bess suite. Is there some compass that you use when deciding on your next recording project, or do you just keep your ears open for something that turns you on?
It's somewhat haphazard. I don't have a master plan, but I put things down. I mean, I don't myself. I don't live for recordings. I mean, I feel recordings are sort of a documentation at a certain point of time. You know, when I was younger, recording the Bruch and the Mendelssohn, it was when I felt ready to do them, I would do them, because I live for live performances, and that's me personally. But of course, recording is an important part. The business, but some of the projects I've done recently were more conceptual, you know, projects instead of just doing the repertoire, you know, actually creating new things or having arrangers create new things like the West Side Story Suite or even the Romance of the Violin album, which I made last year, which was new arrangements of really the great melodies, not violin melodies, but other melodies from other opera or from other instruments, kind of look back to Chrysler and those guys who used to do that sort of arrangements all the time. So those albums, I enjoy those because they're the only ones that, you know, you make an album like that, it's its own idea, and you don't feel. I remember the feeling like when I recorded Mozart concertos years ago, and I felt like it kind of came and disappeared, like it disappeared in the shelves of 50 other recordings and of the Mozart and. But recently I did do a new recording of a standard repertoire. I went back to doing a piece that I've done all my life and even recorded early in my career, and that's the Tchaikovsky concerto. And in this case, it was a little bit different for me because, for one, it was with the Berlin Philharmonic, which I think is just maybe the greatest orchestra in the world, and certainly the very top, and they're incredibly inciting orchestra. So when I had the chance to do something with them and maybe record something with them, I chose the Tchaikovsky. I thought, I'm ready to do it again. Michael Tilson Thomas conducted, and it's live. So it's the first time I'd done a live recording with in concert. We did. There were three concerts. I think they mixed between the three. In fact, I know they mixed between the three. but it was a different feeling, you know, playing in a live like we have here. Even it's nice because often I go into studios and just play for a mic, the lonely mic standing there. It's much nicer to have an audience. You feel much more inspired and. And so I was glad to have that opportunity.
Now, I've read that you said you really wanted to put your own stamp on the Tchaikovsky, which was another reason you went back to that. Well, that must be quite a challenge. I mean, all the great fiddle players over the last 120 years have played the Tchaikovsky. How do you go about putting your stamp on it?
First of all, I don't think in terms of putting my own stamp. That's not the way I think at all about when I play a piece of music like the Tchaikovsky. It just has to happen, like I said earlier about honesty, it just has to be, you can't think, oh, I'm going to do this because it's just as bad to do something because someone did it as it is to do something against the way someone has played it because it's different. You know, you can't play music because in a way that just trying to be different from anyone else. It's just it won't be honest. So in this case, Tchaikovsky, it's just I've lived with it for so many years. I don't really listen to recordings anymore of the Tchaikovsky. If I have free time, I have better things to do with, and it's just become more personal. It's become my own. People often tell me it's unusual. Tchaikovsky is very different from them. It's like I don't even know why they're saying that. It's just it's my Tchaikovsky. And it mm-hmm. becomes that way. So I don't worry too much about that. Everyone is going to have their own stamp and own view and an own way of looking at it. And there are enough variation. There's enough variation in these classics. Even if you're playing the same notes, there's so many ways to. It's like performing Hamlet as an actor. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's so many ways to say a phrase and ways of playing a character that that it will always be new, depending on you know each performer. Always be a classic.
Are you going to play some Tchaikovsky for us right now?
Yes, we're going to play a little piece called "The Melody of Tchaikovsky," and it's part of a three pieces. But I can't pronounce them very well in French. How's your French, man? do you know? It's a souvenir. Do you know what the it's terrible? I always knew them as the three pieces of Tchaikovsky. But anyway, this is the melody of Tchaikovsky.
Again, Joshua Bell and Matthew Bengtson.
Thank you.
Lovely melody by Tchaikovsky, played for us here in the XM Performance Theater at XM Satellite Radio by violinist Joshua Bell and pianist Matthew Bengtson. Let me ask, you're about to play some music by Pablo de Sarasate, another great violinist, mm-hmm. composer. If you have a piece of music, sheet music, put in front of you, how long does it take you to realize that the person who wrote that music really knew the violin?
Well, it's
do people like Sarasate and
Sarasate,
Kreisler?
Obviously, yeah, because he was a great violinist. It, the way they wrote for the violin, Kreisler, Isai, the teacher of my teacher, it sounds very difficult and is difficult, but it sounds even more difficult than it is because it fits the hand very well, and there's a kind of writing that only violinists can really do. And that's why actually composers consult violinists. Mm. You know, Brahms consulted Joachim on his violin concerto, for instance. If you look at the facsimile, the score, there's all kinds of red ink from Joachim. Changed many changes. In fact, Brahms got a little annoyed because he changed so many things, but they're always for the better, really, with the Joachim. And so because composers who are not violinists, they don't always know how to exploit the instrument. Mendelssohn is a great example of someone who just wrote perfectly, I think, for everything he wrote for. The Mendelssohn Violin Concerto just fits the violin so perfectly, and it's often called the perfect violin concerto. But it's such a pleasure as a violinist. There's a joy of just exploiting the violin for what it can do, that one gets from playing the music of Sarasate and Wieniawski and Isai. There's a question over there.
Just step over to the microphone.
I wanted to know, are you strictly classical, or do you practice under other genres of music?
Well, I have done things, collaborated with artists like in bluegrass, or played a song on Josh Groban's album last year called Closer. You know, and then, I mean, playing Gershwin, for instance, is already starting to border on the jazz front. I mean, Gershwin is a great example of someone who sort of mixed the genres. So I don't do a lot of that. I don't believe in, for instance, like, you know, putting a drum beat to Beethoven, although it worked in the 70s for it's okay to dance to.
Fifth of Beethoven.
It doesn't, I mean, I certainly don't think classical music needs to be updated in that way. But there are times where mixing things does work. I mean, the classical composers did it. I mean, Ravel put jazz in there, Brahms and Dvorak putting folk melodies. I mean, that's crossover stuff in a way, if you look at it that way. So sometimes those things do work very well. Sometimes it's trial and error, so it's taking risks. Sometimes collaborations don't work, but I do like to experiment a little bit, and I'm open. You know, if a rock musician that I respected a lot, like someone like Sting or Peter Gabriel, or some, there are many that I really like. If they were to ask me to do something with them, I would certainly be open to doing something like that.
Have you ever thought of playing electric violin?
Well, I have played a little, fooled around on it a little bit. I worked on actually developing an electric violin at MIT at one time. I was working with them on that. And as much as I play on electric violins, there's still, you know, the subtlety you can get from a great Italian instrument, or any violin for that matter, compared to an electric violin, there's just so many more tone colors and things you can get out of an acoustic instrument. That just electric violin has a certain sound which is cool and fun for certain occasions, and you can certainly make it really loud, but the subtlety, so far they haven't created anything electric that can come close to the subtlety and nuance that you can get from a real instrument.
So you don't plan on playing your electric violin on Desolation Row?
You never know.
Bob Dylan reference. So Pablo de Sarasate, what are you going to play?
Oh, this is okay. Sarasate, who is his sort of a rock star in his time. He really was. I mean, people, you hear stories about these guys, you know, women fainting and Paganini and Sarasate. Boy, they were the celebrity rock stars, you know. I wish I were living in that time. So he wrote these, so many of these great flashy pieces, but also beautiful pieces. And this is both. It starts with a beautiful introduction, and then it's a tarantella, which technically means, I guess, the sort of tarantula dance, when you get bitten by, I guess, it's, I don't know the story of a tarantella exactly. You get bitten by a tarantula, and you have to do some sort of dance I don't know where, something like that's where the tarantella came from. But this is the introduction in tarantella. My history is not very good. I should have studied more.
Your history is a lot better than my violin.
Okay. This is the introduction in tarantella by Pablo de Sarasate.
And luckily everybody here is sitting down, but if you do feel faint, remember, put your head down between your knees. And Josh Bell and Matt Bengtson with Sarasate. Thank you. Smokin'. Wow, the introduction in Tarantella by Pablo de Sarasate. Joshua Bell, Matthew Bengtson performing here in the XM Performance Theater at XM Satellite Radio. Wow, I'm out of breath and I was just sitting here. I can see how your tennis background would help you stay in shape for pieces like that.
I just got back from a couple days ago from Ecuador, where I was playing at 10,000 feet up in the air. I was actually more out of breath than I am now, so
I can imagine.
This feels great.
Wow, thank you so much. A couple of closing questions, all designed for very brief answers. If you couldn't be a wildly successful, internationally touring violinist, what job would you like to have?
Then just a regular violinist, maybe. And if not that, but if I had to do something outside of music, I'd probably gravitate towards somewhere in the sciences, either psychology or physics. I always loved physics and science, so I'd probably go in that direction.
Which of the great composers, now long dead, would you like to be able to meet and talk with?
Oh, my God. There are so many. Obviously, I mean, all of the obvious ones, you know, Bach would be incredible to meet. Schumann, such an interesting person. Paganini, I would love to have met Paganini, I think, and to hear Paganini, because he's known as really this legendary, the greatest violinist that ever lived, but we have no recording of him, of his playing. So he would be someone, certainly, I'd be interested in meeting. But, I mean, the list would go on and on.
Well, looking back on the nearly 25 years since your debut with the Philadelphia Orchestra, what would you say is now more important to you than it was 25 years ago? And what is less important to you?
Really, I think one of the things that's less important to me as I get older is caring what other people think. I think that's something, as when you're younger, you worry a lot about that, and worry about what the critics are going to say and what people think. I think as you get older, at least as I've gotten older, I've started to worry less about that and really try to follow what I want to do and what means something to me. But I mean, I still fall prey, of course, to sensitivity to what other people think, of course. But I think that's certainly something, as we grow, musically, we worry less and less about that.
And what's more important to you now?
I'm very careful to make sure that everything I do, particularly in music, you know, every concert I do has some sort of meaning, something important to me. Because at first I was just taking whatever would come my way. I was so happy to play and whatever. But really making sure that, because it just isn't, I realize now there isn't enough time to even play all the pieces that I'll ever want to play or read all the books I want to read in my lifetime. And so making those choices and making sure that every day means something, and as I look back and I don't, you know, regret wasting my time. Although I still forget about that sometimes and waste time playing video games and things like that, which I still do. But maybe that's not a waste of time. I don't know.
Well, thank you so much, Joshua Bell and pianist Matthew Bengtson. Wonderful,
thank you.
Wonderful stuff. I'm Martin Goldsmith, and this is Classical Confidential from XM Satellite Radio.
This XM exclusive original presentation.